To mark the end of season 6, we take the podcast on the road, and beginning at the vast soldiers' cemetery at Etaples on the French coast, we travel across that rural countryside, through towns and villages behind the front, onwards, ever onwards, to the old front line itself, and the city of Arras, and what we find on the panels of the Arras Memorial. There are signs of spring on the old front line. I've come across to France this weekend with my friend John to have a kind of potter around bits of the battlefields here. And I've come just down the coast from the Eurotunnel to Etaples, Eat Apples, or Heel Taps, as the troops called it. The location of the great base depot where soldiers did their training in the latter stage of the war from latter 1916 through to the end of the conflict in the infamous bullring where the instructors, the Canaries, pushed the men through their training before they went up the line. It's also the scene of the famous Etaples mutiny in September 1917, and not far away from where I'm standing at the moment is the grave of Corporal Wood of the Gordon Highlanders, who was accidentally shot by a military policeman that led to some of the rioting. But that's not the subject of this podcast. So I've come down the coast to this vast cemetery, which has fewer graves than Tyne Cot, so it's not the largest British Commonwealth cemetery, but its acreage is much, much bigger, and it gives the impression of being a much bigger burial ground. And around me is the signs of spring. There's bluebells in the woods just to my left, beyond this final plot of graves, which are all from April 1918 in this particular corner of the cemetery. And I just heard chiff-chaffs in the woods there, so I kind of feel that I'm very much back on this landscape of the First World War, this familiar landscape of the old front line. And I'm looking now up towards the two massive towers designed by Edwin Lutyens, one of the principal architects of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, that tower over this mighty, vast, silent city of the dead, which we've looked at in a battlefield vlog recently. And if you've not had a look at the YouTube channel to see that, you can go on there and find that. In fact, I'll probably put a link to that video in the show notes of this particular episode. And it's a cemetery that reflects the British Army in so many ways. The British Army, the British Expeditionary Force, the Empire forces that served, Commonwealth forces that served alongside those British regiments and corps. And we just walked down to this plot past a plot of black soldiers from the South African Native Labour Corps and the British West Indies Regiment, Indian Army soldiers. There are separate plots of Jewish soldiers in here, separate plots of German prisoners of war who died of their wounds or died of sickness and influenza. And the cemetery reflects probably every regiment and corps of the British Army, all of the Commonwealth nations. There are not just men buried in here. There are women, nurses, YMCA workers. There's even the wife of one of the soldiers who came over and died of sickness while her husband was still in hospital here, and he subsequently died of wounds. So there's a husband and wife buried in this cemetery too. Like all of these cemeteries of the Great War, these are kind of time capsules for that generation in so many different ways, on so many different layers. But it's none of that that has brought me here. I'm standing in front of the grave of a private soldier of the West Yorkshire Regiment, Private Luther Jagger. He died of wounds on the 14th of April 1918, having served with the 15th West Yorks, who were the Leeds Pals. And I'm looking at the inscription on his grave, which says, "To the sacred remembrance of a dearly loved son and brother, loved, honoured, mourned." What's my connection to him? Well, as you know from the episode about memorial plaques, they're objects, tactile objects that connect us to the Great War that have fascinated me all of my lifelong interest in this subject. And I saw on a Facebook group recently somebody advertising one for sale, and it was a gentleman who was mindful of the fact that he had no one to leave this plaque to. It was a plaque relating to one of his relatives, and he was conscious that he didn't want it ending up being thrown away. So he offered it for sale, and I could not resist kind of rescuing it under those circumstances. because these plaques, I think they're so incredibly important and such vital monuments to the men and women of this generation. So I got the plaque from him, and he also very kindly sent me a lot of paperwork that has kind of brought that name on the plaque, Luther Jagger, to life. And I'm going to share with you some of the details from that paperwork now, because I think it kind of brings alive the story of one plaque and one name on a headstone in a vast, vast cemetery like this here at Etaples. So with the bronze memorial plaque, and it's one of the very early memorial plaques, it's a dark chocolatey bronze, so it was made in the plaque factory at Acton using absolutely pure bronze, which bankrupted the plaque factory and led to the Woolwich Arsenal taking over production of the plaques, something that we spoke about in the episode on memorial plaques a while ago. But with the plaque was a whole host of documents. And one of them that I'm holding in my hand now is the thing that every family kind of feared in the Great War, and that was the telegram to say that someone had been killed or wounded or was missing. And the telegram boys would come round with these little envelopes, and the envelopes with it too, and then deliver them to the doors of the families with this terrible, awful news, the worst news that they could possibly expect to get during those 4 years of the Great War. So this is a post office telegram from York Army Records to Mrs. Jagger at Highfield Farm in a little village near Wakefield. Regret to report that 43013 Private L. Jagger, West Yorkshire Regiment, died 14th of April 1918 at 6 British Red Cross Hospital, Etaples. Gunshot, abdomen. Infantry Records, number 7, York. And that was it. That was the official notification that they received that their son had died of his wounds. It's pretty brutal, really. Died on the 14th of April 1918 at 6 British Red Cross Hospital, Etaples, gunshot abdomen. I mean, to read that, what must have gone through their mind thinking about the pain and the suffering that their son would have had under those circumstances. But there's another letter that is with it from a nurse who wrote to the family after Luther was buried where I'm standing now. And I'll read that for you next. So this is the letter, and you might hear it flapping a little bit in the background as I read it, because I'm standing here in front of his grave doing it, and it's probably the first time these have ever been read on this spot. The top of the letter says, "The Liverpool Merchants Mobile Hospital, Army Post Office, Section 11, British Expeditionary Force." And it's dated the 18th of April 1918, and to Mrs. Jagger at Highfield Farm, Emily Moor, near Wakefield, Yorkshire. And it's from a matron who was in charge of the ward. She says, "I regret to tell you that your son died here yesterday afternoon. I've not written to you for some time, as he always assured me he could write to you himself, and I know that he did so. He improved considerably for some time, but his wounds were very serious, and yesterday he had some hemorrhage, which proved fatal. Everything possible was done for him, and he had great care and attention all the time he's been here. He will be laid tomorrow in the little graveyard here, where already so many of his comrades lie, a quiet, peaceful little spot within sight of the sea. When this awful war is over, you will be able, probably, to visit it. With much sympathy, yours sincerely, Matron Hitson." They must have felt comforted by that, because they kept this letter. She's quite sharp in some of her language there, which is not uncommon for medical professionals who have to deal with large-scale casualties, which they would have been doing. And she kind of downplayed aspects of it, understandably. She spoke about the small cemetery that he was laid to rest in, perhaps wanting to hide from them the scale of deaths like their sons in a place like Etaples, as I look out across the seemingly endless rows of headstones here today, which would have been wooden crosses. And she was truthful about that he's in sight of the sea, because he's right at the back of the cemetery facing the railway line that's just behind me. And if the trees weren't here, I could see the coast. In fact, I can just see a glimpse of it through the trees now. So there he lies, really, facing dear old England, dear old Blighty, just across the channel. So close to home, but yet so far. And from talking to the gentleman who was the guardian of this plaque within the family, it seems that I don't believe that anyone ever came here to visit his grave. So that wish that the nurse had, that the family would travel here one day, was never quite complete. But I like to think that I've kind of done that for them by coming here today. And I know that a few of you listening to the podcast were so inspired by the episode on memorial plaques that you've gone out and you've got some yourselves because you wanted to have, again, that tactile piece of history that connects us not just to the subject of the Great War, but an individual who was in that Great War and who never returned from that Great War. And it's remarkable for me and wonderful in many respects to see that the podcast has inspired you to do that. And it means we continue to remember these men, and Luther will now rest in my collection, my archive, and he'll be another one of those that when I come back to Etaples, as I inevitably will for work or for the podcast or whatever it is, I can give him a little nod. And he's one of those beacons within a beacon that I'm drawn to when I come here. So this is the start of our trip this weekend, looking at one grave and the story behind his death here. And we're going to continue on across the behind the lines area, behind the British part of the Western Front, over to Arras, and probably dip in and out of a few stories as we go along. I said we'd dip in with a few extra stories as the weekend pushed on, but having walked across Etaples Cemetery into what is one of the separate officer plots, and that's an interesting kind of facet or feature of these behind the line cemeteries, that you see the old kind of class distinctions still very much being in place. And in this plot directly beneath the two Lutyens towers is a big plot of officers, including nurses. So there are nurses in here and YMCA, female YMCA workers. I can see a padre's grave across to my right there as well. And the officers were buried separately because the kind of class distinctions existed this far from the front. Up in the front line, when officers were killed, they were buried with their men. There was no kind of class distinction as the war moved on. In the early phase of the war, there was. If you've been to the aristocrat cemetery at Zillebeek at Ypres, you'll have come across that, where the officers are buried there. But I've come into this plot because we often hear about young soldiers in the Great War. We spoke to Richard Van Emden about teenage Tommies. But there were old soldiers as well. And most people think the oldest soldier to die was Henry Webber of the South Lancashire Regiment. He was a stockbroker from Hawley in Surrey. And he'd lied about his age. He'd gone to Tunbridge School. He's the first oldest old boy of the school to die in the war. In terms of his ranking in the casualty lists, his picture is first in their memorial volume. And it's not of him in uniform, it's of him in just civilian clothes, as a stockbroker, I guess. But he lied about his age, put boot polish in his grey hair or whatever it was he did, got in, got a commission and became a transport officer in the South Lancs, and then was mortally wounded, taking the rations and ammunition up the line around the back of Mamet's Wood in Death Valley in July of 1916 on the Somme. It's buried at Dartmoor Cemetery. And Martin Middlebrook, I think, first drew his name out of the past and mentioned that in his first day of the Somme book. And in the 1976 documentary made by Malcolm Brown, that featured his story as well. So most people, if you ask them, would say Henry Webber's the oldest one to die. He was had 68 on his headstone for a long time, but I think they've now accepted that he was 67. And now standing in front of another headstone of Lieutenant Colonel Jasper Myers Richardson. And I first came across his story in one of my favourite Great War memoirs, The Weary Road by Charles Dewey. And in there there's mention of Jasper Myers Richardson having died of wounds received on the front line, buried here at Etaples. He died on the 30th of March 1918 during the German offensive on the Somme, age 68. So that probably makes him the oldest battle-related casualty in the British and Commonwealth forces in the Great War. And I'm standing in front of his grave now, and someone's put a picture of him on front of his headstone there. He was in the Royal Garrison Artillery, so he was a gunner. He wasn't actually manning the guns when he was mortally wounded. He was the chief gunner, a staff officer, part of the Commander Royal Artillery. And while he was going up, probably to spot for the guns, in the mobile battle at March 1918 was a lot of gun positions got rolled up by the enemy pretty quickly, and the casualties amongst gunners during that period were very, very high indeed. And he was one of them, evacuated from the battlefront on the Somme as the Germans pushed through, wounded, brought back by a hospital train here to Etaples. He died of his wounds, aged 68, on the 30th of March 1918, making him, as we've said, the oldest British and Commonwealth battle casualty on the Western Front, probably in the entire war during the Great War itself. So it's a remarkable grave, surrounded by many other remarkable stories. You know, these cemeteries, as we've said, are very much kind of time capsules of the war itself and the stories of the war and the battles and the fighting, but of individuals whose lives were changed forever and ended here, and the repercussion of their death, as we've heard with the letter of Luther and his parents, affected them so deeply. So beneath these two mighty Lutyens towers, there's lots to think about here at Etaples. We've continued in our little journey down the French coast here in the Pas-de-Calais, and we've come down to the village of Merlimont. And this is just set back from the coast. There's a Merlimont plage on the beach itself. And where the beach is today and where the extension of the town is was a big area of open dunes during the Great War, where the tank corps had their gunnery range. And this is where they taught tank crews how to fire their weapons. Everything from Hotchkiss machine guns, Lewis guns, Vickers guns, right through to the six-pounders that were used on the mail tanks. There were two types of tanks. Mail tank with twin six-pounders, forward-firing machine gun, and female tanks with multiple machine guns in the side sponsons. I think originally Vickers and then later on Lewis guns. And the Hotchkiss machine guns, I understand it, were used in the Whippet tanks, the light tanks that were used towards the end of the war. But we've come here because after the war, I mean, the tank corps were here from, I guess, from their formation, 1917 through to the end of the conflict. And I would imagine that every tank gunner, tank crew kind of passed through here at some point. So it was part of a number of different training areas in this part of the French coast. The machine gun corps just up the road at Camier, for example, they had a training centre up there where they could live fire Vickers guns and teach men how to do enfilade fire and barrage fire and all the kinds of things that was necessary for machine gunners as the war went on. And this was the tank corps equivalent of that. So when the war was over, because this was an important kind of chapter in the history of the newly formed tank corps, they left behind a Mark IV, I think it is. I'll put a picture of it onto the podcast website. Tank that was one of those, I guess, that was either used on the battlefront or was part of the training establishment here. That was a kind of trophy tank that was left behind. There's no trace of that. I wish I was standing in front of that today, but that unfortunately was scrapped by the Germans in the Second World War, so that's not here anymore. But I'm standing now in front of the Village War Memorial, and here we are, you know, I don't know, 100 kilometres from the nearest bit of the Western Front, maybe. And we've got long lists of names of French soldiers from this village of Merlimont who were killed in the Great War. And I'm looking at the statue of a fallen French soldier clasping the drapeau, the flag of France, against his chest as he falls in defence of French soil, with his casque Adrien, his French helmet, lying on the floor beneath him symbolically, having defended the ground and made sure that they shall not pass. And I was just reading on a panel here that it costs the village 12,000 francs in the early 1920s for this memorial to be built. And the Great War list has what looks like about 20, 30 names on it, quite a few where there's obviously their brothers, Albert and Martin d'Albrege, for example. And there's four Gilberts on there, Alcide, Antoine, Félix, Lyon. Some families in France paid terrible prices for sacrifice in defence of France, just like families in Britain and the wider Commonwealth did as well. And then on the other side of the plaques from the Second World War, where there's a handful of men killed in the early period of the war, I would guess, or possibly as free French soldiers, and there's more victimes civiles, civilian victims of the war, people killed in bombardments, because this coastline was bombarded in the post and lead up to D-Day period, where there were a lot of V weapon sites in this area, and some of these would be those who were probably deported and sent to death camps or to work camps in Germany and never returned. But this is not what I've come to look at here, although this is a fine piece of statuary showing a poilu, a bonhomme on the battlefield fallen for France. It's what's in front of the memorial. This is the last vestige of the history of the tank corps here, because incredibly, they survived World War II. There are two six-pounder guns, original six-pounder guns that were used in First World War tanks. Pointing out today towards the roundabout, you can hear the modern world and the cars going round the roundabout in the background, no doubt. But these two First World War weapons, pretty rare beasts from inside one of the sponsons, the turrets of a Mark whatever, male tank with the heavy guns in it like these, used in this case, they could be used to take out strong points, fire a explosive round. They're naval guns originally, because the tanks were a naval project. Churchill, as Lord of the Admiralty, pushed it forward, but it became an army project when the Navy didn't have enough men who could actually drive the vehicles, and the Army Service Corps provided the original drivers of the vast majority of the first tanks. So naval guns in an army weapon, firing a six-pounder high explosive round that could take out strong points, machine gun posts, dugout entrances, whatever it was. But it could also fire a kind of grape shot round, so a shrapnel round that would turn the six-pounder into a shotgun. So if it pulled up alongside an infantry concentration, it could fire at point-blank range into them. And there were instances during the war in which tanks were surrounded, and I guess these kind of weapons were used at close quarters. And here at Merlimont, those crews trained for this, trained on these weapons. And I've got an original postcard from the 20s showing the memorial, the war memorial here, with these two guns in front. And a century on, they're still here. Little souvenirs of the Great War, as the French would say, little reminders of the Great War that connect us to a much wider, much bigger story. The development of tanks, the move from the old world of cavalry and the spirit of Alain. Many of these French soldiers would have died in the battles of the frontiers, in the vast open fields of eastern France or in the Ardennes. An old kind of warfare, but the Great War brought in a chapter of new warfare, and tanks, the rhomboid-shaped tanks, were very much part of that new world of war. And here, these two six-pounder guns kind of point not just to the roundabout today, but point to that history connected to the tanks in the battles, the final battles of the Great War. I've come down now into the main square at Montreux-sur-Mer. Montreux was the location of GHQ, General Headquarters, during the Great War. In the old Vauban ramparts here and in some of the old buildings, the headquarters staff that kind of managed the British Expeditionary Force were located here. And in a little hamlet not far away was a chateau where Douglas Haig had his headquarters for most of the conflict, and then proceed via different methods up towards the front line. After the war, to kind of symbolise this, the importance of this British occupation of Montreux during the Great War, the monument to Haig was placed here, this big bronze equestrian statue of Haig on horseback, which I've just walked up to and standing in front of now. Douglas Haig is a kind of polarising character in many respects of the Great War. So much of what's written about him kind of makes people believe the war was righteous or wrong. And phrases like Butcher Haig are something that we kind of closely associate, I guess, with the history and the historiography, really, of the Great War. But in recent decades, revisionist historians like Gary Sheffield and Lloyd Clark and many others have kind of fought for Haig's reputation as the commander-in-chief and as the person who led a successful modern army into a new world of war. We spoke about that with the tank memorial at Merlimont. That's kind of a characterisation of that new world of war with new weapons and a changing war. The kind of war that Haig probably himself thought that he would fight in the early stages of his military career was not the Great War, and that officers like him, embedded in that kind of military culture, had to adapt and learn and understand. And Haig, I think, was at times good at that and at times not so good. There was a lot of allowing senior officers beneath him to kind of develop the structure of the army and the training of the army and the way the army fought its battles. So I'm not going to kind of write an apology or broadcast an apology as such for Haig, because behind all that are the terrific casualties of the Great War that kind of sours that idea of victory and the experience of the British Army, but needs to be seen in its context. One of the things I think more than a century after the Great War is that we can no longer accept the consequences of conflict, which are casualties. A century ago in the Great War, I'm not saying that they were immune to that or somehow hardened by Victorian values or the experience of the Victorian world that kind of removed a sense of the tragedy of death. Far from it, actually, really, if we look at the way funerary and the approach to the commemoration of the dead after the Great War was done. But I just think that there was an understanding that to fight a war against a power like Germany and to beat them, there was going to be a price. The size, the cost of that price is something that, as I've often said, people will be arguing about for centuries to come. Haig only survived a decade after the Great War, dying in 1928. Generation later, his statue here at Montreux was rudely toppled by German occupying forces who, having swept their way across France in the Battle of France, occupied towns like Montreux. And despite Hitler's later order to respect the cemeteries and memorials of the Great War, even before and after that order, many of them were damaged or destroyed. And Haig's equestrian statue was toppled and the legs of his horse were pointed skywards, and that would remain like that until the statue was put in place again after World War II. The only signs of that damage today are his broken sword on the left side of his horse. And I've seen young French people come across the square as it's lunchtime here in Montreux. People are eating their casse-croûte, their little sandwiches on the benches by the memorial. To the French, probably they have no idea who this is. They may even think it's Marshal Foch, who was the supreme commander on the Western Front in 1918. Haig probably means very little to them now. But he will, as I said, forever be this polarising, divisive figure connected to the Great War. But I think, as with all aspects of history, it's never that black and white. It's important to read and understand Haig, understand the kind of culture that he came from, and how that culture was rudely shaken by the experiences of the Great War in that move, as we've said, from an old world of warfare to a new one. And while we can think of programmes like Blackadder, which is fantastic comedy, it's not a documentary, it's not history. It's a parody of history. And it's important to understand the real lives of commanders like Haig and the impact that they had on the battles and the battlefields and the troops that they commanded, and how they helped transform an army from a regular army to a conscript army by 1918, and were able to take that conscript army made up of young boys, really 18 and 19 years old, to ultimate victory in defeating the Germans, as they did alongside their French partners, and by that stage of the war, the Americans too. So having come down the coast a little way, we're going to continue on our journey across this landscape in the approach to the old front line. I mean, in many respects, these areas behind the lines are part of it. And we're going to continue our journey, and we've got a few little stops along the way as we head, in the words of Sassoon, up to Arras with rifle and pack. Perhaps not so much with rifle these days, but certainly with pack. We've come a little bit further inland now to the village of Leyr in the Pas-de-Calais. And for reasons I'll explain shortly, but having arrived at the village, we've pulled up outside the church. The village is pretty much unchanged since the Great War. This was an area outside the battlefield, so this wasn't bombarded or damaged or destroyed. And the first thing we've seen is on the gate, Commonwealth War Graves Commission plaque. So there are war graves in here, and I'll go and explore those in just a moment. And there's also the village war memorial with a French crapouillot, French trench mortar, in front of it. And this is the thing that fired what British soldiers often refer to as an aerial torpedo, this big kind of sausage-shaped bomb with fins that could be thrown fairly short distance but with quite destructive powers when it hit the enemy positions. So that's part of the war memorial. But the war memorial itself, typical of these ones we see right across France, showing the incredible level of casualties for a tiny village like this. This one is a very interesting one, broken up chronologically with done in 14, 15, 16, 17 and 18. For each year, a list of the men, not just their names, but their age, the regiment they served with and the place they were killed. And in cases of men who were decorated, their medals are displayed there as well. I can see the Médaille Militaire and the Croix de Guerre against one soldier's name, Jean Copin of the 166th Regiment of Infantry, who was killed in the Battle of the Frontiers in 1914. So that's an interesting one. And in that same list of 1914 men is Henri de Ligny. He was 23 when he was killed with the 16th Battalion Chasseurs near Wichita, which is just south of Ypres. And I'm pretty sure that was one of the units that was up against the Bavarians in that sector, which included, of course, Adolf Hitler, whose regiment was in that sector at that time facing the French. And it moves on to 1915. And if you follow 315 Regiment of Infantry Alex on Twitter, you'll see he often does a lot of really interesting tweets for a start, but also has done a lot of research based on some of the research that Dave O'Mara did, the late Dave O'Mara, about how important that year of 1915 was to France and how deadly it was. And if I look at the list for 1915 and the different places that are mentioned, there's locations where these casualties fell. I can see Quincy up in northern France. Got a local tractor going by. I can see Les Epages and places in the Champagne as well. And there's quite a dominance of local regiments. 110th is one that's quite frequently I've seen on there, which must have been a local regiment to this area. We move to 1916, and amongst the casualties there, I can see Bras, which is on the Verdun battlefields. I can see Bray-sur-Somme, kind of reflecting the role of the French army then. And when I look at the 1917 battles, I can see Messige on there. Now, we've covered Messige on the podcast, and I did the video for the video blog for that area. There's Chemin des Dames listed here. Zoudecote up on the coast where the French were alongside the Belgians. So it's kind of a really interesting memorial reflecting France's greater war and the sacrifice and the battles that the French army fought in different locations. So even here outside the main battlefield area, you can come to a place like this and very easily connect to the history of the Great War. And I do find these French war memorials absolutely fascinating, the kind of statuary that's on them, the depiction of sacrifice. On this one, it's a fairly plain one with the flags and a Adrienne helmet and a Croix de Guerre on there. There's no statue of a French soldier, but it's what the memorial tells us and the information that it gives us. And we're looking at a original piece of Great War trench weaponry here with this crapouillot in front of me. So the reason that we're actually here is because John, who I'm travelling with, his grandmother's cousin was Lieutenant Colonel Alfred Murphy of the 2nd Battalion Leinster Regiment. And John listened to the podcast episode that we did on letters from the trenches and was inspired to get together the collection of letters between his grandmother and his grandmother's cousin, Colonel Murphy, and transcribe them. And in one of those letters, he comes here to this village of Lair, which he describes as a small country village with an ancient pump, a majestic church, which I'm standing in front of now, which is made from the white chalk stone and is typical of many of the very old churches of this area. So he describes it as a majestic church, a charming old curé, a few dogs and several ugly old women. So we won't comment on that last statement. There's no one about in the village. But as we've come into the churchyard, there's a building on the right here, a long double-storey building with a typical kind of northern French Flemish roof. But it's a long rectangular building. And to me, it screams estaminet. It's a cafe. It's a place where soldiers would have gone to. And I look at it and I wonder what kind of conversations went that took place behind that door during the Great War, because Colonel Murphy wasn't here on his own. He was a battalion commander. He commanded the 2nd Leinsters. They'd just been in action during the Battle of Arras, just to the north of Vimy Ridge, alongside the Canadians, at a place called the Bois-en-Ache, where they'd fought alongside the Royal Sussex. And he'd just come out of the line from there with his battalion, and they were in rest in this village, quite a few miles behind the front line. So when I look around me now and see some of the old houses that would have been here more than 100 years ago, these are the places where Murphy's men of the Leinsters would have been billeted in these buildings. We pass an old barn on the way in with a kind of wattle and daub walls, which is typical of the kind of billets that soldiers had when they were in places like this. So I'm going to go for a little walk around. Often in these churchyards, you come across war graves. There's definitely some in here from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission plaque. But the other thing is, there's often graffiti on the churches. British soldiers, when they were out of the line, like to leave their mark. And there are many, many places that I've found over the years where I've found the names of British soldiers carved into chalk stone, like the kind of chalk stone that I can see on the church that's in front of me. So I'm going to have a little wander now and see what I can find. So I've explored quite a few of these old churches in villages behind the lines, and I've walked around this one. There's a lot of scratches and names, French names, from the 1700s and the 1800s, and one or two kind of more later Poilu names on there. One thing I've always found is that you often find a lot of names around a church door, and I'm in an arched doorway here, which is absolutely covered in graffiti, most of it French, but looking amongst it, I can see there H. Adamson, 1916. So at least one British Tommy has scratched his name on the wall alongside these generations of French people that have come here. And I find this graffiti in places like this behind the lines absolutely fascinating. There are names on buildings right across this area behind the lines in northern France where soldiers out on rest, a bit of spare time, perhaps run out of money in the estaminet, can't buy any more drinks, have come down here and perhaps seen the fragility of life on the battlefield and wanted to leave something of themselves behind and have carved their names into this northern French stone, and it'll be here probably for all time. So it's another kind of place where you can reach out and touch the past. And there's one or two names I can see written in what look like filled pencil there, but they're so faded it's almost impossible to really see what they say. But the war grave, I think, is just around the corner, and we're going to go and have a look at that now. So I've found the war grave, and I'm walking over to it now. It's tucked in alongside some modern French burials, or relatively recent French burials. And it's driver Richard Albert Golden of the Royal Horse Artillery, who died on the 28th of October 1915, age 34. He's one of thousands of isolated graves like this scattered across this northern French landscape in the areas behind the lines. Who knows what happened to him? Killed in training, killed in an accident. Circumstances of his death aren't immediately clear. Perhaps someone listening to the podcast has researched him and knows more about him. But it kind of shows how much there is of the Great War, even on this landscape away from the main battlefield areas. We can find the crisscross paths of it, the traces of it, just about everywhere we go. And if we stopped, I think, almost in every village between here and Arras, we would find something that connected us back to those events along that old front line. So no trace of the Leinsters, no trace of Colonel Murphy. Their stint in this village was short, but it was a place of rest for them. And of course, soldiers spent just as much time, sometimes more time, in places like this away from the battlefield as they did on the actual frontline positions themselves. So these are the kind of places that they would often remember, not just the shell-pocked landscapes and the trenches and the bunkers and the smashed woods, but villages where there was life, where there was fun, drinks and laughs with your mates. It was all part of the soldiers' experience in villages like this, like Lair, where we are now. It's early morning in the city of Arras in northern France,
and I'm just walking up a side street from the Place de Ipswich. Ipswich was one of those places that twinned with Arras, possibly because of the large number of battalions of the Suffolk Regiment that served here during the 1917 battle. So when I stand here in the Grand Place and the sun's just coming up over the rooftops, catching the buildings and the glass of those very ornate structures that surround this square, sometimes it feels as if the Great War never happened in places like this. They rose like those phoenix from the ashes and lived once more. But this square was known to the British as Barbed Wire Square. The French, in the early phase of the war, fearing that the Germans were going to come into Arras, had wired the square up. And that wire was still here when the British took over Arras in 1916. It remains an important sector in the British and Commonwealth story of the First World War. And just about every unit that passed through the Western Front passed through this sector at Arras at some point and was here for one of its big battles, whether in April and May of 1917, in March of 1918, or the counter-offensive that pushed the Germans back finally in the summer of the same year. And I always find this Grand Place evocative because I know that, for example, there's photographs of British troops assembling in this square on the eve of the Battle of Arras or during the Battle of Arras in 1917. But I also know that in the restaurants and the shops and the buildings that are in this square, beneath them are cellars. And those cellars were used by the British Army to shelter its troops. Many, many thousands of soldiers lived beneath ground here at Arras in this system of cellars. And when I think of some of the veterans that I knew who were here, George Butler, who I mentioned in a recent podcast on Red Ann Ridge, he was here with the Machine Gun Corps in 1917. He slept in these cellars in this square beneath Arras. And Alf Rizel, who was with the Royal Fusiliers, who I'm going to reach out and touch part of his Arras story later on this morning when we go around to the Arras Memorial. He was here too, and so many others that I interviewed. So the Great War really, although on the surface these buildings recovered, life moved on. Last night here in Arras, it's a very modern city now, and young people were enjoying themselves just as they should. That's what I guess the resolution of conflicts and the end of war is about, for people to go on and live their lives normally. Although at times the Great War feels distant, equally, I think for me, it feels very close when I know the history of places like this and I know what's beneath this landscape. And it's not just the cellars, because the New Zealand Tunnelling Company came to Arras, part of the New Zealand Engineers, and the French had used a whole system of chalk quarries, subterranean chalk quarries, which had been used for many centuries to quarry the stone of which probably many of these buildings around me are made of. And the French had used those as shelters. And an idea developed to connect them up, to create this underground world which British and Commonwealth, British and Empire forces could use. And the New Zealand tunnellers did this, creating this vast system that by 1917, I can't see the roof of the cathedral from where I'm standing now, but soldiers could join the tunnel system near there, for example, unseen by the enemy, and move through that tunnel system right up into the forward zone of the battlefield and shelter underground, be protected underground, and be ready for the assault that was about to be made. The Canadians used a similar system for the assault on Vimy, but the British used a much, much bigger system built for them by the New Zealand engineers, the New Zealand tunnellers here for the 1917 offensive as well. So there's an underground element to the story at Arras, and it's literally beneath my feet here as I walk the streets of Arras this morning. Like many of these frontline cities and towns and villages that were close to the fighting zone, incredibly civilians still lived in them. I suspect not here in Barbed Wire Square, but certainly in other parts of the city of Arras. It's mentioned in many of the memoirs. I was reading recently a memoir of a soldier in the Royal Fusiliers who mentions being in houses that were empty in one area, but civilians were living in others very close to where he was. And at the cathedral, which I can't quite see the rooftops of from where I am here in the Grand Place, there was a famous photographic studio where in part of the ruins there, you could stand amongst those ruins, giving a kind of a warlike experience or appearance to your photographs and have your portrait taken or group photographs taken. It's a fascinating kind of subject and something that I might return to in a dispatches, looking at soldiers' photographs of the First World War, not just the ones that they took, but the ones that were taken of them. Many of them actually in theatre, on the battlefield, even in cities so close to the front line like Arras was. But the modern world is coming to life here this morning. The cars are gradually coming off the ring roads, across the cobbles, into the square. People are parking up to head to the market in the next square in front of the Hotel de Ville, the town hall. And Arras, life in Arras, continues just as it should. But I'm going to head now round to the Arras Memorial to the Missing, to look at the missing of the battles of Arras from 1916 until the end of the war. So I've come this morning to the Arras Memorial to the Missing, and this commemorates over 35,000 British and Commonwealth soldiers who fell at Arras from when the British first arrived here in 1916 through to the end of the conflict. But it's a memorial that's dominated by two very specific periods of the war. Firstly, the Battle of Arras in April and May of 1917, and then the German offensive of March 1918. And when we look at the names that are on here, we see those dates crop up time and time again. And although it's one of the smaller memorials to the missing, it still represents an important part of the story here at Arras, because if we look at the casualties in the Battle of Arras, particularly in 1917, a very high proportion of them are commemorated here. So very few men killed in the Battle of Arras in 1917 have a known grave. And there's a number of reasons for that. I think it's to do with the kind of fighting that took place at Arras and the bombardments that continued throughout the rest of the war, destroying field graves. During my time of living on the Somme, I came up to see several field graves that were found by archaeologists at Arras, of the Royal Fusiliers, of the Suffolk Regiment. So there were graves that were lost due to shellfire and later battles. But I remember when I was writing my book on Arras, one of the things that I discovered was that in many of the units that went over the top into the Battle of Arras in 1917, they started issuing orders that when soldiers went into battle, they removed their paybook and their identity discs and handed them in before they went over the bags, over the top. And I think that kind of happened for a number of reasons, kind of security scare for soldiers captured. The paybook and the dog tags actually revealed quite a lot of information about him and the unit he was in. And the Germans knew what the order of battle of the BEF was, and that would give them some kind of vital intelligence information. But it could have been other reasons for it as well that have been lost in the mist of time. But what it meant was, of course, is that men went into battle with nothing on them to say who they were. So if they fell and their body lay in no man's land or in a German trench, and they were found by other units, burial details and whatever it was, then there would be nothing to say who this soldier was, and they would be buried as an unknown. So I think that was a contributing factor as well. And there was one attack at Arras on the 3rd of May 1917, when the Canadians advanced to the north in the Douai Plain, and various British divisions went over the top in the centre area of the Battle of Arras, in villages like Monchy and Cherisy, and then to the south at Bullecourt, the Australians attacked there. In that battle, a very, very high proportion of the dead do not have a known grave. And for the British soldiers, they're commemorated here. The Canadians, they're on Vimy, and the Australians, they're on the Villers Bretonneux Memorial. So it is a battlefield with quite a high proportion of missing soldiers. And as you walk along the panels, you see the famous regiments
of the British Army. The Commonwealth names on the memorial are South Africans who served in the 9th Scottish Division. Their original brigade commander, Brigadier General Lukin, was now commanding the 9th Scottish Division, and he led them into battle over the Pont de Jour on the first day of the Battle of Arras on the 9th of April 1917. But there's a separate section of the memorial, the Air Services Memorial, which I'm looking at now, which is a column with a globe on the top. And the globe is set to the point that the world was spinning on its axis on the 11th of November 1918. Quite a nice nod to the ultimate victory in the end of the war. And on this memorial are commemorated nearly 1,000 airmen who were killed over the Western Front. Some of them I know were ferrying aircraft across and crashed in the Channel. But there are men who have no known grave, who died with the air services and have no known grave. Royal Flying Corps, Royal Naval Air Service, and they were then combined on the 1st of April 1918 to become the Royal Air Force. So there are RAF names on here as well. And I'm just walking round to the RFC names, because at the very top of the panel there is Major Lano Hawker, DSO, VC. So he was a recipient of the Victoria Cross. He became the first pilot in the RFC to get the VC for shooting down an enemy aircraft, which was over Sanctuary Wood in 1915. His victim, Hans Rosa, is buried in Sanctuary Wood British Cemetery there. And Hawker went on to fly, leading a squadron into action, and on the Somme in 1916 fought an hour-long aerial duel with the Red Baron von Richthofen above the skies close to Ligny-Tilloy and Fleurs, when he was shot down near a farm behind the German lines and crashed and was killed. And the Baron went to inspect his crash sites, Lano Hawker's crash sites, and took away some souvenirs from the aircraft, but made sure that Hawker was properly buried. But later fighting destroyed his grave, which is why his name is on the memorial here. So that's an early Royal Flying Corps Victoria Cross recipient on that side of the memorial. When I come round to the far side, we come to the RAF names. And towards the top of the panels there is Major Mannock, VC, DSO, MC, Mick Mannock, one of the top scoring British aces of the war, a man who was a telephone engineer in Turkey when the war broke out, was interned by the Turks when they entered the war on the side of the Austro-Hungarians and the Germans, and was released, joined the Royal Army Medical Corps, eventually through his mechanical and electrical skill, got into the Royal Flying Corps as ground crew, and then a lot of routes to flying for ordinary men was technical knowledge. And through his technical knowledge, when I think it was with 40 Squadron, under a Major Tilney, they were a balloon-busting squadron, he gave Mannock a chance to be a pilot. And although Mannock had poor eyesight, obviously firing machine guns at balloons was, in theory, not a difficult process, but he kind of honed his skills as a pilot and became, as we've said, one of the top-scoring aces of the war. He was shot down up in northern France when he took a new pilot out on patrol and broke one of his own golden rules, engaged an enemy aircraft. Instead of pulling up and pulling away, he went down beneath the aircraft and ground fire hit him and his aircraft exploded in a fireball. Now, I'm here with my friend John, and some years ago John made a programme based on Peter Hart's work, Aces Falling, about the flyers of the Great War. And we looked at Mannock's story for that and went to the bit of the battlefield where Mannock crashed, where after the war an unknown aviator was exhumed from there and is buried in Levante Cemetery. And I know aviation historian Andy Saunders has petitioned for a long, long time to have that grave recognised as Mannock's. I mean, whether it is or it isn't, I don't think we'll ever properly know, but the evidence is very, very strong. But for now, he remains here, commemorated on the Air Services Memorial, part of the Arras Memorial itself. And I'm just going to wonder, I mean, there are so many stories with 35,000 names on here. There are thousands and thousands of individual stories. And in the years of coming here with Ledger Battlefield groups, I've brought many, many families to come and reach out and touch their relative's name on the memorial. And it's always a very, very special pleasure to do that. but I'm just going to focus on a name that's on the panel here, and then we're going to drop down into the cemetery, which is part of this site. So you've got the Arras Memorial itself, and then the Faubourg d'Amiens Cemetery right next to it. But before we get to that, we're going to walk up to the Middlesex Regiment panels. And on here, when I look at the names, on all these memorials that are missing, the names under each regiment are in order of rank. Officers first, and then ordinary soldiers. So with the Middlesex Regiment, it begins with captains, and then lieutenants, and then second lieutenants. And under the list of second lieutenants, as I go down to almost kind of waist high from where I'm standing now, is second lieutenant Tull, WDJ, Walter Tull, one of the first black British officers. He was a man who'd been a professional footballer before the war and joined the football battalion of the Middlesex Regiment, the 17th Middlesex, on the formation of that unit in 1914, served with them on the Somme, was sent home and then applied for a commission and was granted a commission in the Middlesex Regiment and served with the 2nd Football Battalion in France, in Italy. And then when they returned from Italy to serve back on the Western Front, he was killed in the German offensive of March 1918, and his body, like so many killed in that offensive, was never recovered. So his is an important chapter, not just in the history of the British Army and in the history of the Great War, but a chapter in the social history of Great Britain, recognising that forgotten army of black soldiers who served in British regiments during the Great War, something that we spoke about in an earlier podcast. And if you've not heard that one about the experience of black soldiers in the British Army, you can go back through the podcast catalogue to find it. So Walter Tull is on here. Now many, many groups come to see Walter Tull's name, school groups, and recognise the diverse nature of the British and Commonwealth forces in the Great War. So that's Walter Tull, and we're going to return to the Memorial to the Missing in a little while, but now we're going to walk down into the cemetery here to have a look at some of the graves. I've walked down into the Faubourg d'Amiens Cemetery now, and the Faubourg d'Amiens is kind of a district of Arras, which was in the direction of Amiens, the city on the Somme in the distance, way in the distance. And I guess it's a bit like the Menin Gate and the Lille Gate. This was a route out of Arras in the direction of Amiens. I don't know if there was a specific gate here way back in kind of medieval times, but that's this side of the city that faces towards Amiens. And just up the road behind me is the old Vauban barracks that were used by the British Army in World War II. The Gestapo took over the moat, and that's where they executed members of the SOE and the French Resistance, and there's a memorial to them there. But I'm in the First World War cemetery here that sits alongside the Lutyens-designed Arras Memorial. It's a spectacular site, and the memorial itself always reminds me of a kind of Greek or Roman temple. And the cemetery is an interesting one because there's a very, very high proportion of identified soldiers here, so we know who these men are, and it gives us a very good kind of cross-section of the kind of men that came to Arras during the First World War from the British and Commonwealth forces. And I've dropped down into the 1918 section now, which is very heavily dominated by Canadians, because the Canadians fought the final Battle of Arras in August of that year, as they pushed the Germans back over the old battlefields towards the DQ line, the Drocourt-Queant switch line. And that's where, in August and early September of 1918, the Canadians began to break the Hindenburg line. So this part of the cemetery reflects that period. But if I look right to the back of the cemetery, and there's close on 50, 60 rows of graves as I look across the cemetery here, we're going back towards the early casualties of 1916 there. But just before we get to that, I'm just going to cut across to one of the graves at the end of plot 6, row D, which I'm just coming into now. There's a lot of gunners in this part of the cemetery as well. Royal Field Artillery, Royal Garrison Artillery, which kind of testifies to the importance of the artillery in these battles of 1918. It was a war of the guns in so many, many ways. And victory on the battlefield was achieved by many things, but by the coordination of artillery for sure. And even I've just walked up alongside the grave of Gunner Skuse of the Royal Marine Artillery. So they were here with their super heavy guns operating in support of the Unna gunner elements. But it's a grave at the end here that I remember seeing on my very first trip to this cemetery with my dad in the 80s. And it's Major Sinclair Travis of the Royal Garrison Artillery, who died on the 26th of March 1918, age 31. So he was a siege battery gunner who fell in the March 1918 battles here at Arras. But the interesting thing, on the reverse of his Commonwealth headstone is the original grave marker. It's a stone cross which reads, "Rest in peace, Major N.B. Sinclair Travis, RGA 297SB Siege Battery, who died on the 26th of March 1918. And that's made, I would guess, from Arras stone, possibly from one of those underground quarries where the soldiers were sheltering during the Great War, placed on his original grave by the officers and men of his unit, and the family have requested that it stay here. Now, this is very unusual for that to happen, but stay here it has, and it marks his grave just as it did more than a century ago, but with the addition of a Commonwealth Imperial War Graves Commission headstone as well. And I'll put a picture of that onto the podcast website. And now I've moved across into the next main plot of the cemetery, and these are graves from 1916 and 1917. And one of the things I know about this part of the cemetery is there's quite a few men who were shot at dawn who were executed by firing squad, and I'm walking up to a couple of those now, Private Patterson of the East Surrey Regiment, and then Private J.E. Barnes of the 7th Battalion, the Royal Sussex Regiment, who was executed on the 4th of July 1917, aged 24. Now, we've looked at soldiers who were shot at dawn again in a previous podcast episode, and it's a complex story. It's not really like all history, it's not black and white. Barnes was a repeat offender. He deserted before. He had a suspended sentence of death hanging over him. And if you came up against a field general court-martial for the second time and one of those behind you, then your chances of being let off a second time were pretty, pretty slim. So he was found guilty. The sentence was death, and that sentence was duly carried out on the 4th of July 1917. Now, one of the myths of the soldiers who were shot at dawn is that the families were never told. They did receive a letter from the War Office telling them what had happened. Whether they relayed that information to anyone else is another thing. But Private Barnes came from Littlehampton in Sussex, and his name is on the war memorial there. And a local priest went round and knocked on the doors of the families in Littlehampton to ask them whether a loved one had died in the Great War. And when Mrs. Barnes was asked, "Did your son die in the Great War?" she said yes. She just didn't say how he died. So his name was added to the war memorial. So a century or more on from the events of the Great War, an army that marched on discipline had to have discipline, otherwise it was a rabble. But the whole issue of executing soldiers, like I say, is a complex one. The good thing now is that they were all subsequently pardoned, except for the ones that had committed capital crimes, murder. And the families of these men know that they are officially recognised and remembered, just like everyone else buried in this cemetery. And standing here in the uniformity of an Imperial War Graves, now Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery, there's nothing on these graves to indicate that these men have been shot by firing squad. They're commemorated in exactly the same way as the men who are buried around them. Uniformity in death, and that's an important thing. And it is a cemetery, this one, connected to the 7th Battalion, the Royal Sussex Regiment, because I'm going to, and that's obviously being a Sussex lad, I've always been interested in the Sussex stories, and I'm just going to walk up to the end of the next row where I know there are two important graves. And I've told their story, I think, in this podcast before. It's Lieutenant Colonel Sansom and Captain Gilbert Nagle. And Sansom was originally in the 5th Cinque Ports Battalion of the Royal Sussex, and he was a headmaster from a school in Hastings. Gilbert Nagle was from an Anglo-Irish family, and he originally joined the 7th Battalion, which was a new army battalion formed in 1914, and he was the adjutant of the battalion. So this is the commanding officer and the adjutant, both of them killed on the 5th of July 1917, the day after Barnes was executed here at Arras by firing squad. And they were up in the front line at Monchy-le-Preux in a captured German dugout, where the exit of the dugout faced the German lines, which was often a kind of deadly prospect. And they went up the steps of the dugout to see flares being fired up like fireworks displays over the infantry hill there at Monchy, when a shell pitched out the darkness and landed right beside them and killed both of them instantaneously. Colonel Sanson was 50 years old, and he had in his pocket a letter from the War Office telling him to go home to resume his headmastership. He'd done his bit. He'd been at the front since 1915, so 2 years, but that was never to be. And Colonel Sanson remains here for all time alongside his adjutant and so many others of his battalion. So it's a fascinating cemetery, and there are many little characters. Having researched the Battle of Arras over many years, I wrote my book, Walking Arras, to kind of get people walking this battlefield in the same way that they do the Somme and Ypres. It's not as visited as those battlefields. I was sitting this morning with John at breakfast talking about how crazy that is when you consider it's one of the closest battlefields to the Channel ports and the tunnel. It's only about an hour to those. And you've got a magnificent city with so much Great War history around it and so much to see here, but it's not as heavily visited. And there are some very good books on the Battle of Arras. Now, John Nichols led the way with his Cheerful Sacrifice in the 1990s, based on the interviews he did with veterans. Jim Smithson has written on the subject as well, and John Cooksey did some books on the Arras battlefield. So there's a lot out there now, and other titles besides, that you can kind of dip into Arras, and it's really important to do so. And come to this cemetery at Faubourg-d'Amiens. I mean, many people come to the Arras Memorial, but look at the cemetery and read the names and see the units. There's a New Zealand Engineers officer here who I think was part of the New Zealand tunnellers that we mentioned when we were in the barbed wire square, the Grand Place, this morning. So there's kind of every facet of the Arras story commemorated amongst the headstones in here, from padres to decorated officers to soldiers shot at dawn to captured German soldiers who died of influenza. There's Indian Labour Corps men in here. There's even a Russian headstone of a Russian soldier captured on the Eastern Front, forced to dig the trenches and the bunkers of the Hindenburg Line, who escaped with another lad across no man's land until they bumped a post held by Colonel Sampson's battalion, the 7th Royal Sussex. And when they were challenged with the password, came out with a language which sounded like German, and the men opened fire, killed one Russian, wounded the other one, and he was taken back down to a dressing station and survived. But the other one was buried here, the only Imperial Russian soldier buried in this cemetery, and one of many buried across northern France who were in these Russian units forced to work by the Germans behind the lines on railways and the digging of construction sites like the Hindenburg line. So it's a fascinating, really engrossing cemetery in many ways in terms of the history that's in here for us to discover. And probably many of you listening to this podcast will have your own connection to this place. But I'm going to head back up into the memorial now and just finish off with one story that connects me to a veteran of the Great War. I've walked back up to the palatial corridors of the Arras Memorial with its tall columns and long wing of panels, giving it this kind of feeling of a place of remembrance, a place of sacrifice. And it brings me into the names from the Royal Naval Division who fought at Gavrel. We spoke about the Marines there at Gavrel in a previous podcast episode, and then the corps and the regiments of the British Army then begin on the panels. And I'm working my way down those to the Royal Fusiliers. I can just see them coming into view on my left-hand side with Major Turney's name at the very top, but it's not an officer who I've come to see on there. One of the Great War veterans that I knew was Alf Rozelle. Alf Rozelle served at Loos and on the Somme and here at Arras with the Royal Fusiliers. He was a wartime volunteer, a kitchener's man from 1914. He was one of the most incredible Great War veterans that I knew. Could talk for a very, very long time about his war experiences, but in a meaningful and detailed and absolutely fascinating way. I invited him down to our Sussex branch, Western Front Association, all those years ago, and he stood up and he spoke almost non-stop for a couple of hours. And an incredibly generous man with his time and his patience in taking questions from people like me who wanted to know more. And he was desperate, really, that the story of his war and his comrades was never lost. And he appeared on a few documentaries. The best of those is The Game of Ghosts, which I have mentioned many times on the podcast, and I would thoroughly recommend it. It is an absolutely magnificent documentary about veterans in the Great War, the best in my mind, and the way it's filmed and the way it's presented and the way that they even just shoot the veterans, film the veterans by kind of blacking off the background behind them and just letting them speak as these incredible talking heads. And Alf is incredibly eloquent on there about his experiences and what his beliefs were. And one of his stories connects us to this panel I'm standing in front of now, because one of his best mates was William Hubbard, Bill Hubbard. And as I look up the list of names here, I can see him. There he is, Hubbard, W, Bill Hubbard. And on the 3rd of May 1917, that deadly day at Arras, Alf Rozelle's battalion went over the top near the village of Pelves, and he was captured in the fighting there. And as he was being led away, he looked down in a shell hole, and there was the very badly wounded Bill Hubbard. And Alf got permission from his German guards to see how Bill was. He had a terrible wound that Alf took one look at and realised that it was unlikely that he'd recover from that. But he asked if the Germans would provide stretcher bearers to come and take him away. They weren't that interested. And Alf promised Bill, he said, when I get back to an officer, a German officer, I'll request that someone sent to you to come and get you. We won't leave you, Bill, we won't leave you. And he was led off, and no one was interested in what he had to say about a wounded British Tommy lying in a shell hole. And he had to put that behind him. And Alf spent the rest of the war as a prisoner of war in Germany. That always haunted him, because he felt responsible. He'd not caused Bill Hubbard's wound, but he felt he'd not done enough to try and help him, try and save him. And it haunted him, and it haunted him, and it haunted him, until one day John Nichols, who wrote that book, Cheerful Sacrifice, brought Alf back here to Arras, and he stood where I'm standing now, and he looked up at Bill Hubbard's name, and something in him kind of changed. He was able to put that, as much as he could, he was able to put that behind him and live those final years of his life in some kind of peace. It was not an unsettling thing to see Bill's name, but actually quite the opposite when he came here. And that is the thing, when we look at these graves and we look at these names on memorials, their deaths affected families, tortured wives and mothers and daughters and sons, wondering what had happened to them, particularly with the missing whose names are on this vast panel that I'm standing beside now. But each death affected a comrade or comrades, and this was a common factor when I was interviewing Great War veterans. They would often ask me about somebody. Could I look this person up? Could I go and visit his grave or see where he was? And sometimes it was difficult because they only had an army nickname like Chalky or Ginger. But several of them I was able to help and come and find a name and find a grave. And just like Alf, it kind of settled them in those final years, helped them deal with their experiences here on these battlefields of the Great War. And today, when we reach out and touch these names, I think it does link us not just to the families of the fallen, but the comrades of the fallen, the survivors, sometimes the forgotten survivors of the Great War, who went home and lived their life in the shadow of these men's names who are carved on these mighty memorials that stand for all time right across the old front line.
You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCorps. You can follow the podcast at Old Frontline Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.